Today is Christ the King Sunday, a relatively new feast in the liturgical calendar. We bring out our festive white paraments, sing our hymns of royal praise, and apply kingdom language in ways that hopefully resonate in our lives today. Today, when a pandemic surge, societal uncertainties, and a fresh lockdown all force us to tease our circles apart from the delight of touch and taste and festive gatherings. And with all of that as the backdrop today, perhaps it's a bit much to engage in the revelry imagined for this feast of Christ the King. Let's cast our eyes back to its origin, back along history's tenuous thread to the year 1925, December 11th to be exact, a papal bull issued by Pope Pius XI established Christ the King Sunday. It eventually settled into its current place on the last Sunday of the church year, that is today, inviting us to pivot into Advent with all of that season's hope and anticipation of Christ coming again in great glory. Anglicans adopted the feast too, so here we are, trying to make sense of its purpose and meaning in our lives, when only some 30 monarchs still remain worldwide. Perhaps the feast and its royal reference point are just too anachronistic, or too patriarchal, or too tethered to an outmoded faith tradition to find a centering point in this feast. If that's how you feel, know you are not alone. This feast is problematic, at least as it's come down to us. But as is the case with all human history, there is something in this occasion that will serve us in our lives even now if we will make the effort, if we will reflect, if we will glean. As George Santayana famously said, those who do not remember the past are destined to repeat it. So let's return to December 11th, 1925. A rather dismal year is drawing to a close, one most would have just as soon forgotten, prompting a well-meaning but heart-heavy pope to exhort the faithful to focus on Christ the King. Here are the few of the year's most noteworthy developments as the backdrop. In Italy, Benito Mussolini dismissed the election results, dissolved parliament, and declared himself the dictator. In Germany, Adolf Hitler published Mein Kampf, launched his political party, and created a personal security force known as the Schutzstaffel, or the SS for short. In the U.S., in 1925, some 35,000 members of the KKK marched on Washington, D.C., and its 5 million members made it the nation's largest fraternal organization of the day. The newly elected President Calvin Coolidge introduced new isolationist and xenophobic restrictions on immigration, cutting rates as much as 90% from some countries. In Tennessee, the Scopes monkey trial, as it was called, found high school teacher biology teacher John T. Scopes guilty of teaching Darwinian evolution, which had been outlawed by the state legislature and governor as suspect science. And F. Scott Fitzgerald published The Great Gatsby, exploring the decadent underbelly of the classist American dream. Now, all that and a good deal more unfolded that year, even as the heavy memory of World War I and the influenza pandemic lingered in the air. So you can understand why Pope Pius was grieving the state of things. And as historian and monastic Silas Henderson writes today, this pope at that moment was bemoaning the fact that the world was bowing down before the lords of exploitative consumerism, nationalism, secularism, and new forms of injustice. Meanwhile, colonial empires were dancing in the post-war geopolitical landscape that saw new regimes bear down on whole peoples, as did the profiteering that fueled them. And so into all of that mix, Pope Pius called for Christians to seek, quote, a king of peace who came to reconcile all things and whose dominion was cosmic in scope. Seems reasonable. The problem was and is that the iconic image of Christ the King, which the church promoted, was written with the same paint of worldly power and gathered into its orbit the unseemly detritus of human kingdoms, which so often measure dominion as by a yardstick of battle victory and conquest and wealth accumulation and nationalistic fervor. The Pope unintentionally created a new feast that in large part circled back on the very behaviors he was trying to subvert. And it didn't work, because here we are, many of the same lords of exploitation, white supremacy, a distrust of science, classism, are playing their salacious tunes as loudly now as ever. We still need an alternate vision to sober us to our current reality and the threats we face. And let's be clear, it's not just the people out there that are attuned to those salacious things, those politicians or profiteers or evildoers. The prevailing sin of our time is selfishness, as Michael Curry says. He's echoing Jesus when he says that, because surely we all know how selfishness can seduce us into justifying our behavior. My precious. Theologian Deirdre Good wrote a book entitled Jesus, the Meek King, in which she suggests we miss the point of this king of ours and the nature of his kingdom when we juxtapose the victorious Christ in battle with the meek Jesus, when by meek we mean tamed into submission and weakness. Who would choose that? But it's a false choice. Meekness, as a gospel virtue, intends something much more magnanimous and transformational than simple submission. Jesus, as meek King, comes as the consummately compassionate and merciful one who is driven by philanthropic impulse, philanthropic literally love of others. He chooses to relinquish power when he could do otherwise. And it's precisely that kingly image of meekness, set in contrast to the imperial powers of Jesus' day and ours, that we so desperately need, that casts the alternate vision, that changes the world, that invites you to sit wherever you are this morning and ask yourself how his meek ways stir you to meekness in your life. Not tamed submission or weakness, but meekness, compassion, and mercy, and philanthropic and unselfish giving of yourself. We know this world desperately needs that. I need it in my life. I know you do too. This Christ the King will not make sense otherwise. And it won't work if you hedge your bets. The rich man in the Gospels that wanted to follow Jesus, he departed empty-hearted even while his pockets were brim full. Embracing meekness is much harder than a half-hearted pledge of allegiance to some organization or institution or theory or notion. If you focus on those people out there who are far worse than you are and whose comeuppance is necessary for you to have satisfaction in your life, any hope of nourishing meekness as a virtue in yourself will be strangled. Meanwhile, if you focus in your meekly efforts all in on yourself, your mighty meekness, look at how great I am in my meekness, the gift will slip through your fingers like water. No, the magic, the meaning, the power of this meek king's transformational approach to life touches us precisely when we open ourselves to the reality that every last soul on earth is inherently good and worthy of our love, worthy of God's love. This meekness, this meek king opens up and appears before us when we believe that this king of ours really does come to reconcile all of creation. That his dominion is cosmic, precisely because no one is left out. But this king lingers in the margins, not in the hallowed halls of courtly prestige and worldly power. When we meet him in the margins, meekness then can become the quality that shapes our lives too, unleashing a transformative power that will make talk of victory over and conquest and wealth accumulation moot. And so we make our prayer once more, your kingdom come, O Christ, your will be done on earth as in heaven.